Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for coming back. And I thought I might have sort of driven you away last night, but I'm under strict instructions that we have to start at 8, and I think we've just missed it by a moment or two. Up until now, I think in the first two lectures, we've been relatively macro, maybe a little bit abstract, around the concepts of the state. And in the next two lectures, what we'd like to address are some of the, what I think are extremely complex and difficult issues that any modern state has to deal with, but I think they're particularly difficult if you're a developing state and you aspire to developmental goals. I can't easily think of anyone better to talk about this that I know in South Africa. I'm sure there are many, many people, so it's people I know. But Chippy Olver, as we were discussing earlier this evening, starts as a medical doctor, becomes a real activist in everything. He became involved in government, in the RDP office with Jay Naidu and others, then moved as a director general with Vali Musa into constitutional affairs, because he is responsible for some of the local government issues. So if you want to discuss this matter with him, you're welcome to. And then where I think he had, in my view, with due respect to him, the greatest impact when he became Director General of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. And I think a great deal of our dispensation and what I think is by and large common good sense is due to Chippy. He tells me he's going to be controversial, and these characters that I brought along to these lectures always surprise me. But Chippy Olver.
Well, thank you very much, Alec, for those kind words and for reminding the audience of some bits that maybe shouldn't be reminded of. The local government debate, I'd love to engage on, but it's going to take us on a whole nother journey. The topic that I want to focus on tonight is the environment and how it fits into the current debate about the developmental state. It's not on the screen. Great. That's my proper name, Crispian, but my friends will call me Chippy. And Linked is the name of the environmental consulting business that I run. And this is broadly the outline of what I want to try and cover. It's a slightly ambitious task, and Alec has promised to cut me. He's going to give me a 10-minute warning, and then I'm just going to run through the rest of the slides. But I want to pose one or two questions about what a developmental state is, and then look at the relationship between environment and development and some of the concepts that have been used to inform public policy about how to manage the environment. So we'll look briefly at things like the value of environmental services. I want to touch on a concept called global public goods. And then driven to the core issue of equity, and I'll explain that as we get to it, which is basically how we equitably share environmental benefits and costs, not just locally and nationally, but globally. And then if time permits, we're going to talk a bit about sustainable development and how it's applied here in South Africa. We'll look at a few mechanisms, and we'll talk a bit about participation and governance. So that's the outline. Now, I'm not a theorist like Alec, but you know, my fairly crude understanding of the development state debate is that there are two broad paradigms. There's the model that, you know, for decades was punted by the World Bank and others, the Asian Tiger model, which is largely a set of autocratic, very interventionist and growth-focused states. And then there's a whole another body of literature which takes a very different tack, which is focused on democratic states, redistribution, very development focused, and it sort of broadly falls under the rubric of people-centered development. And I'll leave you to judge which of those two camps I'm in at the end. The answer's not obvious, I must warn you. And one of the key arguments in the developmental state debate is that instead of doing business as usual, providing your traditional set of government services, you need to understand the development impact that those services have and be able to use it cleverly and direct it across the broad range of things that states do: services, infrastructure, taxes, planning. But one of my core arguments is that to be a developmental state has to be premised on being able to do the basics first and to do them efficiently. So it's the efficient delivery of core services, also the absence of corruption and proper accountability. We're in a situation now where, quite frankly, most states are not developmental. I mean, the big phenomenon of our day, climate change, which we're going to come back to later. In fact, quite frankly, national states, particularly at Copenhagen and more recently at Cancun, have been abrogating their responsibility, and you're finding a lot of cities leading the mitigation efforts around climate change. And quite frankly, global governance in the environmental arena, also in the other arena, is in disarray because of these narrow competing state interests always at the negotiating table. And my big caveat, I mean, I'm not, in fact, quite frankly, a fan of the word developmental state, particularly in the South African context, because there's this ugly flip side, which I call the anti-developmental state. And that's where states try and be developmental states with an expanding state influence, but on the basis actually of a weak, inefficient, and corrupt state. And, we have littered across South Africa a lot of experiences. I was relating to Alec my experience of setting up a rural project in the Eastern Cape, where I just have to honestly say, at every turn, the government bureaucracy has been an obstacle. And that's to someone like me, who's quite well resourced. I've got a cell phone, I've got access to resources. Rural farmers trying to get something started face this massive impediment in being able to move development forward. And in some places, we should strip away the state because it's standing squarely in front of development happening. So all of what I'm saying, is premised on this anxiety I have about whether we go developmental or anti-developmental. Now, my job's slightly different when we look at the environment, because unfortunately the environment is one area in which clear, direct state intervention is absolutely necessary. And I'm going to build the argument around that. It's also, unfortunately, been, I think, very much ignored in the prevailing discourse around the developmental state, particularly, the ANC, COSATU party kind of discussions. And it's primarily viewed as a constraint and added as an afterthought. And I'm going to hope to argue convincingly against that. The core issue here is that natural resources need to be viewed as development assets. And they permeate almost everything that we do in terms of the society and the economy, from the generation of fresh water, soil and soil integrity and nutrients, biodiversity, big economic sectors like forestry, fishing, tourism. The environment is present in almost every aspect of our economic and social life. And we depend on functioning ecosystems. And if we lose them, we will compromise fundamentally our ability, even in the short term, to deliver on social and economic objectives. And you know, I've just flashed up. This is a picture of threatened ecosystems in South Africa, and the red are the critically endangered ecosystems, the ecosystems that we are losing as we speak. And the orange and yellow are endangered and vulnerable ecosystems. But what's quite startling from this picture is the extent of South Africa's surface that is facing very severe threats in terms of ecosystem integrity. And I'm going to come back to this issue later when we talk about ecosystem services and overlay a map of where those services are coming from. You're all very familiar with climate change. You maybe are not as familiar with some of the details about how it's going to hit us. But the current climate models, I mean, this is drawn from the government's recently published policy on climate change. You know, by 2050, a 1 to 2 degree warming at the coast and a 3 to 4 degree warming in the interior, which may not sound so bad, but by the end of the century, cataclysmic warming in the interior. I mean, 6 to 7 degrees is going to devastate profoundly our agricultural systems. It's going to change disease patterns. The natural distribution of biodiversity is going to change fundamentally. The Cape Floristic Kingdom is in threat of disappearing. And as South Africa, we're quite vulnerable to climate change. We have a large, fairly poor population. We've got inadequate housing, often poorly located in floodplains on the coast. We have a high vulnerability to communicable disease, and with these temperature rises and extreme weather events, things like malaria, you know, gastroenteritis are going to change their natural distribution patterns quite fundamentally. We also we're a water scarce country. We've got a low and quite variable rainfall. Most of our water resources are already allocated, and this is going to have profound impacts on agriculture, food security, and people's livelihoods. And this is in fact quite a short run projection, because normally when you're thinking about climate change and its effects, you're thinking in terms of hundreds of years. But it just shows you, it's a picture of the different water catchments, and the blue ones are those that are currently in balance, so there's enough water coming out of the environment to meet social and ecological needs. The green shows areas of surplus, and the red is areas where we're out of balance, where there's a gap, and rivers are drying up. And you can see just in the shift from 2000 to 2025, one of our catchments, in Limpopo, shifts from imbalance to shortage. Two of the catchments, Upper Orange and the Fish Tsitsikamma area, go from surplus to being in balance. And these are fundamental changes over a very short time frame. I haven't shown you the outer years. A lot of it's quite under debate, and people are not as convinced about the change as this. But this is, these are fairly definite projections they've been using now by water affairs planners. So you can get a sense of the scale of what's going to happen. And this is an environmental event with very, very profound effects. So, I've been sketching a little bit of the negative side, and I suppose emphasizing really the constraints that the environment does pose. But there are other ways of thinking about it, and one of the concepts that is used is called ecological footprinting. And it's quite a simple way of thinking about impact. And it's basically the amount of productive land that you need to survive, live your life. And it takes account of all the land needed for agricultural production, energy generation, carbon sequestration, so capturing all the carbon that you generate, and absorbing the wastes that you generate. And South Africa's average footprint is just over 4 hectares per person. Now, if we were to apply that average to every person living on the planet today, we would need 2 planets to sustain the world's population. But this average, in fact, masks quite profound inequalities. And very importantly, the middle-class suburbs of Cape Town, which is represents most of us, if we were to apply that formula, we would need 5 to 6 planets to sustain everyone on the world. And that's very similar to, say, the US level of consumption. Whereas if you were to take the Cape Flats and poorer communities on the Cape Flats, we'd roughly need between 0.5 and 1 planet if that was the level of consumption everyone enjoyed. And it's very similar to levels of, say, India and China, who, of course, are at a very early stage of their growth path. And the Worldwide Fund for Nature, WWF, has calculated what they think is a fair share. So what we would need in order to maintain our world in balance, and that's roughly 1.8 hectares, which is quite a profound change. I mean, if we were to adjust our daily lives to, 1.8 hectares of land to support us, as middle-class people, that's about a third of what we currently consume. And the adjustment required is quite a profound adjustment. That's one way of looking at it. On the more positive side, there's this concept of ecosystem services. And this is where ecosystem services are services that the environment provides. They're like core services that support a whole lot of our activities. And it's used to calculate quite often by economists the development value of the environment. And just some examples of ecosystem services would be the way that the environment not only supplies clean and fresh water, but also regulates its flow, particularly through wetlands. And when you degrade your wetlands, you get flash flooding as a result. And we've covered some of this other stuff before: soil formation, nutrients, food production. And you can, in fact, add. You can attach an economic value to those services. And there have been many studies. This just looks at the market value in South Africa of some elements of those services. So, for instance, if we were to use biomass, which would be wood chips and plant material, to generate energy through a gasification process, it would be an annual value of about 3.5 billion rand. LPG replacement with biogas, 1.2 billion. Water, based on our current levels of infestation of aliens, between 0.5 and 2.5 billion. But if we project it into the future, when we're going to have massive alien infestation, between 2 and 10 billion in terms of value. I'm just rounding it up. It's 1,000 million, which is a billion. And carbon sequestration, if we were to price the ability of the environment to capture carbon and take it out using current prices that you're getting on the carbon market, a value of about 9 billion. These are big numbers, and you can if you add it all up, come up to an economic value of the environment. And there's a whole sort of, you know, discipline around that. And people have in fact mapped where the areas are in South Africa that are particularly important for some of the ecosystem services. And that shows you that the green areas are areas that sort of rate very highly. And if you just cast your mind back to the map I showed you, in fact I should have put it in here and I didn't. But there's a very high overlay. The map I showed earlier of the ecosystems that are under threat and very vulnerable. You know, very high clustering, you'll remember, in the Cape, along the eastern escarpment, KZN, down in the eastern Cape areas. So a lot of this area that is critical for providing core ecosystem services is also vulnerable or under very severe threat. There's another concept which is very profound and in fact is now the mainstream approach to thinking about the environment, and that's this concept of sustainable development. And it was coined by the Brundtland Commission, which started out in the 70s and came up with this profound paper called Our Common Future, which really set the modern environmental era going. And their definition is that sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And it introduces this concept, which I want to come back to, of equity between generations. Intergenerational equity. And traditionally, sustainable development is seen as the intersection of three interlocking disciplines or areas. So it's about protecting the environment and valuing natural resources, but doing that in balance with the social agenda, which is about addressing social needs and poverty, and an economic agenda, which is about ensuring cleaner production and sustainable economic growth. So, you know, the early debates on sustainable development were about locating it there at the intersection of these three interlocking circles. And there's been a whole international regime that's been built on this concept. And we've made huge progress from the 70s up to the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, which agreed this very progressive Agenda 21, a global program of action on the environment. And then flowing out of that summit, a decade of summits and conferences that put into place all of our key environmental conventions and frameworks. So the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Convention on Biological Diversity, the conventions around waste and pollution like the Basel Convention, the Montreal Protocol around ozone depletion, and the list goes on. There's, you know, there's a string of at least 20 key global conventions regulating different aspects of the environment. And then in 2000 we had this landmark Millennium Summit that the UN convened, where the Millennium Development Goals, which are really a set of development goals, but they include environment in them, were adopted. And we as South Africa were very unfortunate in 2002 to host what was called the World Summit on Sustainable Development, where we were able to weave a whole lot of these little agendas together into a comprehensive global plan of action. And you know, people like Alec were, I think, key negotiators in the government team at that summit. So that's that's the international regime. And you know, weaving all the way through it has been the sustainable development concept, which has got two very important premises, and I'm going to build on the arguments around this. I mean, the one we've really covered, which is the integrity of natural, financial, and human capital, the intersection of these three domains. And the other concept, which was already floated by the Brundtland Commission, is this concept of equity. And it's equity within generations, and it's equity between generations. And I'm going to have a little bit of a look at that as we go on. Now, that those three interlocking circles have been slightly dissed by some people, and in fact South Africa's taken a slightly different view, which is called a systems view of sustainability. And in fact, the systems view says that sustainable development isn't the small little area of intersection, but it's in fact a view that ecosystem services, which we were discussing earlier, really create the context and the framework within which your entire socio-political system is embedded, and within which in turn your economy is embedded, all of which is held together by a governance framework. So the systems view actually sees these systems as not just having the small area of interconnection, but being entirely mutually dependent. And this is really the prevailing view, and it's been taken up by South Africa and captured in some of our very progressive policies. The last concept I'm going to float, and I'm sorry to put all these concepts on the table, but we're trying to summarize 40 years of global debate and put the core concepts together. But the last concept I'm going to bore you with is called global public goods. And it's really come about in the last decade. It was touted as a new paradigm for international cooperation and particularly funding to the environment. And there was this quite high-profile task force that came out with a very long-winded and ambitious report. But what's quite important is that it's been used as the thinking behind donor support into the environmental sector, and particularly funds like the Global Environment Fund, where they are funding things on the basis that they have a global public good element. And the key thing about global public goods is that without collective action, they're often undersupplied, or the converse, that global bads are oversupplied. And, just to give you some of the examples, they're not just in the environment area. It would be things like preventing the spread of infectious disease, or international peace or financial stability, or preventing climate change. And some public goods, this is where I have a bit of a problem with the concept. In fact, not all public goods are global. Some of them are regional, like shared water courses, and some of them are far more local, like a waste-free environment. And the other problem I've got with the concept is that it doesn't take account of historical responsibility. And a lot of the climate change debate the carbon in the atmosphere at the moment is historical carbon. It's carbon that's come from the industrialization process in the developed world. It's not developing world carbon. I hope that's not too faint. I think it's a little bit more useful to break it down more and look at what level benefit is experienced. Let's take an issue like waste management. A clean environment matters a lot to you. If the lid is not picked up in your street tomorrow, you're going to notice it. It's got a profound local effect. Its effects at a national level are not that profound. There might be a greater disease burden. Its regional effects are even less, and there is some global benefit, but it's not a lot. So you can see that waste management has a very particular curve in terms of where benefit is located. Whereas if we take a completely different issue. This is not a big issue for South Africa, but it's a huge issue for Brazil with rainforests, preventing deforestation. If we save the Amazon rainforests, there is a massive global benefit in terms of carbon sequestration, water and climate regulation, etc. There's also some regional benefit, particularly on the water side. But there's a profound disbenefit to Brazil as a country, because they would forego a vast amount of development that would come from, in fact, alternative land uses there. And there's some local disbenefit, because people will be foregoing employment opportunities, etc. So when you start to look at an issue like deforestation, you can see that there's a very clear basis for a process of subsidization from global, certainly to national, and I would add to local level as well. And I think it's better to look at, you know, the different environmental issues and unpack them in terms of the level of benefit and disbenefit. And that has implications for how financing takes place. And what I've just quickly put up here in a very crude way is to show, you know, different allocation mechanisms depending on where the level of benefit is. So if it's local benefit primarily, you know, your principal financing mechanisms are then going to be through things like user charges, the local tax base, and even private financing. Whereas if you're shifting to, you know, primarily state level benefit, it's redistribution through the national tax base and budget, up to regional and ultimately global level, where you're using, you know, donor funds, some of these big global funds, and the trade regimes to create the desired levels of cross-subsidy. So that's the end of the theoretical concepts and global public goods and disaggregating it and looking at the levels of benefit and the linking that to the subsidy mechanisms. And I want to now bring it back home a little bit more and talk about South Africa's own commitment to sustainable development. Now, we've got a very progressive policy. We've got this thing called the National Framework for Sustainable Development. It's published in 2008. And yeah, it's motherhood and apple pie. It's got all the right things, all the right principles. It commits us as a country to a whole range of measures to try and balance consumption and production with the Earth's capacity. And we've backed it up with a suite of very progressive legislation. So, you know, starting with our constitution, which puts the right to environment that is not harmful to health right up there in the Bill of Rights. We've got some very important framework legislation, the National Environmental Management Act, which enshrines in law a whole lot of principles like the polluter pays principle or the waste management hierarchy, which is a way of managing waste. We've also got the Water Act, which is, from an environmental point of view, a very profound piece of legislation, because it talks about, as a first call on any water resource, the obligation to meet the ecological needs of a river and the basic human needs, the minimum needs that humans need for survival. So that's enshrined in law. And then on the basis of that, a set of sectoral legislation, air quality, waste management, biodiversity, protected areas, coastal management. There's all that. Good policies, good laws. You know, I'm not convinced that we're getting the balance right. And I think there are a couple of critical areas where South Africa as a country and our government is still not achieving the necessary level of integration. I'm going to point to just a few areas. The one is climate change. Now, I don't know if any of you were following the debate about the Integrated Resource Plan The integrated resource plan is basically the country's plan for how we're going to generate energy. It's a long-term plan. And it talks about the energy mix that goes into that plan in terms of fossil fuels, nuclear energy, renewable energy. So it's a sort of master plan for energy generation into the future. And as you know, most of our carbon emissions are coming from our electricity generation, from our coal-fired power stations. So there's the IRP, which is now on the table after a long consultation process. And on the climate side, they've got this thing called the long-term mitigation plan, which is basically how we're going to adjust our economy to reduce our emissions to a certain level. And that plan's based on what they call a peak, plateau, and decline scenario. In other words, for the next decade, our emissions are going to continue to go up as we start to bring in the technologies and prepare the way for an adjustment. We're then going to plateau out our emissions for a decade, and then we're going to drop them, both in ratios and in absolute terms. So we've got this peak, plateau, and decline scenario on our emissions, and we've got an integrated resource plan that isn't a peak, plateau, and decline IRP. So there's a huge disconnect. The IRP has brought in a whole lot of renewables. They've brought in a lot more nuclear power. I'm not sure Cape Town will be too happy about that. But you know, there is a there's a misalignment. The IRP is still not compatible with the peak, plateau, and decline mitigation scenario. And you know, quite frankly, there's inadequate use of South Africa's renewable potential. We've got massive solar potential. We've got quite good wind potential in some areas. We've got a large biomass potential with our sugarcane fields and other areas. And one would have thought that we'd be seeing a far more aggressive level of investment. These are slightly more expensive technologies at the moment, but with the rate that the electricity price is going, and with the long-term potential penalties that we're going to face for being carbon intensive, if we don't make the adjustment now, we're going to be putting our economy into a very difficult position. So there's a disconnect on climate change. The other one that's in the news at the moment is mining. I don't know if you've been following the debate about mining in Mapungubwe, which is happens to be one of our national parks. It's also a World Heritage Site. But bless me, the Department of Mineral Resources has been granting prospecting rights right next to the World Heritage Site. And we're currently in danger, in fact, of losing World Heritage Site status in Mapungubwe. And, you know, there's, again, there's a disconnect between mineral resources and how they think about mining and where mining can happen, and the environmental regulation side. And unfortunately, in this country, environmental regulation still rests with the Department of Mineral Resources. So they sign off the environmental impact assessments for new mines, as well as for the EMPRs, which are the management plans for the environment that are drafted by the mines. And having mineral resources do that is really, you know, having being player and referee, because their brief is to promote mining. Their brief is not to protect the environment. So you can see even in that area, you know, another disconnect. And I can show you disconnects in, you know, at least 10 other areas if we had time, and we can maybe explore it in debate later. So I want to start drawing this together and come back to the sort of question Alec asked me to really talk about, which is what is the role of the developmental state? And as you know, first of all, you know, get the basics right. And there's, you know, we can debate the basics, but it's basically, you know, do it efficiently, do it effectively, and do it with integrity. Root out corruption, cut the free riders, sort out governance. We can discuss that. I think it's a key issue. You know, sort out governance, accountability, participation, co-regulation, and an active citizenry, because particularly on the environment, it's an area in which the state doesn't always lead. In fact, often the state follows, and it's civic action and civic movements that push through. Then fundamentally ensure equity, and it's ultimately states that have the ability through the budget, through the tax base, to drive mechanisms of reallocation and subsidization. And then use strategically the raft of interventionist and facilitatory tools. And just, you know, as a quick snapshot, Alex told me my time is nearly up. I wanted to give you a sort of cross-section of the kind of tools that states use in the environment space. So there's a range of, I mean, if we're looking at this axis of state-led interventionist, there's what we would call the command and control stuff. Regulations, mandatory reporting, penalties, enforcement. Doesn't sound like nice stuff, but sometimes it's very important, all right? Also on the state-led side, but more facilitatory, the soft power tools, governance, education, sharing of information, funding and subsidies. And then moving across to more private-led initiatives, but still interventionist, using market-based instruments, taxes, user charges, deposit refund systems, for instance. And then lastly, you know, private-led facilitatory using a raft of co-regulatory instruments. Now, I don't think that any one of these, you can't have a diktat about which of these is better. In fact, in particular situations, some are more appropriate and some aren't. But, you know, typically, you know, we would build a base with soft power tools, get a baseline regulation and culture of compliance going, use market instruments to incentivize behavior, and then try and extend action using partnerships and encouraging voluntary initiatives. And locating all of that, as I said, within a sound governance framework, participation, accountability, active citizenry. So that's, you know, roughly what a developmental state should be doing, and its armamentarium. But and fundamental for me is ensuring, this is just going back to our levels of benefit and mechanisms, ensuring cross-subsidization in order to drive equity. So to wrap up, firstly, the environment is an indispensable resource for development, but it's inequitably shared. And I would say there's an inequitable allocation of responsibilities for fixing it if we look at the historical backlog. We've talked about a sustainable development framework, and I think that is the framework within which a developmental state should be operating. Global and state intervention is necessary to drive equity, and our biggest problem is that we don't yet have an equitable international governance system, and the climate change debate that we're going to have on our shores in Durban in November and December of this year is going to be a classic example of this, you know, Herculanean battle between developed and developing world about how these costs are allocated. I think I've made this point. Efficient, effective, and economic state. I think what Pravin Gordhan is now calling a strong state is a prerequisite before we can talk about a developmental state. Getting the regulatory environment right, eliminating corruption and rent-seeking, and getting the governance framework right. And I'm going to end with a slogan that's, in fact, from the Rio Earth Summit. So when Agenda 21 was being adopted, the slogan on everyone's lips, which really got broadcast around the world, is don't get paralyzed by what seems like intractable negotiations and problems and corrupt states and things not happening. Think global, have a global perspective, but act local, do something, take initiative, make a difference, even if it's in your own small world. So that's the talk, and I look forward to the questions and discussion.